Ah, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And it is Monday, so that means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Colin was not able to join us. He has a gig booked, and he wasn't unable to join us this weekend. We were going to have Jim on, but Jim's power went out at his place, and his phone cannot be charged, and he doesn't have a landline. So that's why we can't have Jim on. But we'll get I've heard what Colin and what Jim think of some of the movies that came out this week, and we'll have that in there. But it's just going to be me and Eric handling the movies this morning. And we've got a bunch of new ones to talk about. We'll also talk about the box office and all that cool stuff. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. My dad will be calling in to tell a jokey time. And we're going to talk about the most popular recipes by state and a bunch of other food topics that we've got here that we haven't talked about. I've got a bunch of food topics that we want to get to. So we're going to talk food as well on this Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And let's get to the movies. And let's welcome Eric Childress. Hey, Eric.
Hey, man.
How are you?
Okay.
All right. Before we get to the new movies, you know, last week we had to talk about Martin Landau and George Romero.
Yeah.
And this week we lose John Hurd.
Yeah.
I was just 72 years old. And, you know, he's one of those guys that people remember. You know, they know his face.
He's, of course.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. But you really, you know, some people, I mean, we obviously know the guy's name. But
right.
He's one of those guys that shows up in a bunch of movies that you've seen. And I guess most people, you know, like all of the obits for John Hurd, they all mentioned that he was the dad in Home Alone.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the one that he's most, I suppose, recognized for. But he's
certainly probably the most popular film he was ever in.
Yeah.
So just most people just know him from that role.
Right. But he's done so much more.
Yeah.
And is never bad. Like he's always great in everything that he does, in the movies and everything that he's ever done. What are a couple of your favorites that you'd like to point out?
Well, I mean, the one thing that clearly comes to mind, if Home Alone was his most popular, then I mean he has to be remembered for Big as well, where he basically played the villain to Tom Hanks's character. And you know, the exchanges that he has, and he's got that like wonderful bit of physical comedy where he's playing handball with Tom Hanks, racquetball, where it should be handball, but they're playing racquetball, and just tackling him in the outside. It's just, I mean, there's just things like that, and it's you don't even want to choose between everything that he did, and remembering that when he popped up, you knew that something interesting was going to happen.
Yeah,
that he was going to be some sort of integral part of the story, and it's just small parts. He popped up here and there, and sometimes he just pop up for one minor scene or something like that, and he's like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, there's a few that I'd like to mention. That Heaven Help Us is one where he played like the cool brother at the Catholic Church who smoked and hung out with the kids. He's great in that movie. Great and very likable and very funny. He's fantastic in After Hours.
Yeah.
As the bartender. He's he's only got like three scenes in it, but like like when he can't get the cash register open and he's like, "What if I have a rush right now?" So I loved him in that. I remember really, digging him in Cat People.
That's one I think about.
He's great in that. Chilly Scenes of Winter is this very little scene film that he's terrific in. And one of his best roles is Cutter's Way with him and Jeff Bridges. He's remarkable in that movie. I think that the title now is Cutter's Way, right? Because it was released as Cutter's Way and Cutter and Bone.
Right. No, it's frequently known as Cutter's Way.
Right. I just want to make sure people get the right movie. And I loved him in that. In the Line of Fire, he was terrific in the Line of Fire. I mean, it just goes on and on. But one of my favorite performances of his is in 187, where he plays the totally, the alcoholic, disillusioned teacher who likes to bring guns to school. And there is a scene in 187 where Samuel Jackson is at John Hurd's, and by the way, his name is Childress in that movie.
Of course he is.
John Hurd's, and John Hurd's last name in that movie is Childress.
Yeah.
But there is a scene in that movie where, you know, the Dave Childress invites him over, Samuel Jackson, over to his house. He goes into his garage, and they've been drinking. He's been drinking heavily. And then he starts showing him his gun collection and whipping out the guns and, you know, and acting like he was pointing them at students and stuff. And it's one of the most chilling scenes in the entire movie. And that movie's a chilling movie all the way, but really like a terrifying scene. And he's so great in it. So,
yeah. And, I mean, you mentioned Cat People. I mean, we got to sort of have to give props to him, you know, for a starring role. He had a horror movie called Chud.
Yeah. Oh, please.
You know, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, all, you know, we talk about all the small parts that he's in and, you know, all the supporting roles over the years. But, you know, I mean, was that the only time he had, like, a, I mean, other than Chili Sees the Winner, was he the lead in that?
He was the lead in that. He was the lead in Cutter's Way, too.
And Cutter's Way, yeah. And Chili Sees the Winner just came out on Blu-ray from Twilight Time.
It's a terrific movie. If people have, and by the way, Jim Laskowski, who was going to join us this morning, who couldn't, wanted to make sure that we mentioned that he recommends Cutter's Way and Chili Sees the Winter.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not real popular movies. So, you're going to discover how much talent this guy had. He was a terrific actor, a great actor, and will be missed. And it was weird. They haven't really said how he died. He had surgery a few days earlier.
Yeah.
But was not in the hospital. He was in a hotel room, they found
him. Right.
So, but he was only 70. He was just 72 years old.
72.
It sucks. That really sucks. And he's one of those, you know, he's one of those character actor guys that you could count on. Like, if he's one of those guys that if you saw his name in the credits, you go, oh, good. There's,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be at least one good performance in this movie.
Right.
And that's the deal.
Like Sharknado.
Yeah. Right. Right. Totally forgot he was in Sharknado. And he was hilarious in it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the other thing is that he could be very, very funny. He was he could do drama. He could do serious stuff, but he was also incredibly funny.
Yeah.
So, and people might remember him, fans of Beaches. Might remember mm-hmm. him. He was in Beaches as well, and that was a very popular movie, too. So
sure.
It's too bad. John Hurd passed away, and we just wanted to mention how great an actor he was and how he will be missed. And I guess he's got some stuff in the pipeline that he finished.
Yeah.
At least I see like 6 credits
mm-hmm.
That are completed or in post. So we got.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll be at some film festival or something, and he'll just show up.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Eric, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a break. Eric Childress is with us this morning. Colin couldn't do it. He booked an early morning gig, so he couldn't do it this morning. Jim was going to do it, but he had a little issue with his power, and he can't be with us. So it's just Eric and I, and we got a bunch of movies to talk about, and that's coming up. But right now we got a break for the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. We're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with your opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and that means my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's sponsored by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And I thank George and everybody at the Gale Street Inn for being awesome and for sponsoring my dad's joke. Check out galestreet.com. We're also going to, speaking of Gale Street, food, we're going to talk about food. We got a bunch of food topics that we're going to get to that we're going to have some fun with a little bit later on as well. But right now, it is movie time. Colin Suter could not join us this week. Jim was going to fill in, but he had a little issue with the power at his place, and no landline, and his phone was dead. So he was not able to join us this morning. But Eric is here, Eric Childress, and he will review the movies with me, and we will talk box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, have you been looking at any of the Comic-Con trailers?
A few of them, yes.
Did you see the new Thor?
Oh, yeah. The Thor trailer is better than either of the other two Thor movies.
I
like the first one.
I totally agree with you, man. And I love the first trailer. I thought the first trailer, little
first
teaser trailer,
fun.
Was great. And they used the Immigrant Song by Zeppelin. I can't believe it took them 3 movies to finally use that song.
Yeah.
But this one, this just looks so great. And I read an interview with the director. Now, do you know what his biggest influence was for this movie?
Taika Waititi?
Yeah.
Maybe I did read this. I'm blanking.
Because it's pretty awesome. It's Big Trouble in Little China.
I saw that mentioned. I didn't see that as an influence, but I did see that brought up.
He said he wanted Thor to be like Jack Burton in this movie. And I was like, this is going to be the greatest movie ever made.
That's great.
And if you look at the trailer, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, it very much looks like a Guardians of the Galaxy on, you know, fill in your drug here.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It looks completely colorful. It looks completely, you know, bat crazy.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's really amping up the humor, which is exactly what I wanted to see knowing that what TD was going to be involved with it.
Yeah. Well, it looks great. And those are some of the trailers that they've been, teasing at Comic-Con. All right. Well, why don't we start out with a movie that you did talk about, Lady Macbeth. You saw it at what fest?
Sundance.
You saw it at Sundance.
Yeah, premiered at Toronto last year. I saw it at Sundance this year. And this is a British film version of a Russian novel that actually has nothing to do with Shakespeare.
Right. Now, I have to say, I saw the trailer for this movie, and it looks really interesting. Like, really, really interesting.
Yeah, and it's an 89-minute movie, so it's a complex, simple story of a woman in sort of the mid-19th century who is basically put into an arranged marriage by a guy's father, and the son has barely any interest in her, you know, barely even wants to touch her, just wants to use her for his own gratification, even though it means putting in no effort. So there's the woman, is played by Florence Pugh, who plays Catherine in the film, and she, you know, just discovering her own way around, you know, being alone and discovering her own passions, and begins an affair with a local gentleman, and I think he works around the place where she is, you know, now betrothed, and things get complicated from there. It involves infidelity, obviously, and murder, and double crosses, and all kinds of crazy stuff, basically living up to the title of Lady Macbeth without actually being Lady Macbeth.
Right.
And it's, like I said, it's a simple, complex story that, you just use the word interesting, and it very much is. I mean, it is, you know, if you're a fan of that kind of intrigue and dark storytelling, and we have a lot of movies this year and this summer, particularly about women taking full advantage of newfound power, and this is certainly one of those, but certainly in the darker realm.
Yeah,
Florence Pugh is very good in the film. I mean, the film takes some really dark, nasty turns in it, it's always interesting. It's really quick. It's good stuff. People should really seek this one out.
Cool. And it's playing in three theaters. It's playing at the River East. It's playing at the Landmark Century and in Evanston.
Yeah.
If you want to see it, it's interesting because it's a period piece as well, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. And, no, it's set in the mid 19th century, like 1860 something.
Yeah.
And I mean, you don't even want to give away too much of the plot. That's about as far as you kind of want to go. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, this movie, you know, no one's safe. In this movie, I'll just say that.
Well, and it's interesting that this comes out a few weeks after that Rachel Weisz movie, My Cousin Rachel.
Yeah, not just that, but also The Beguiled.
Yeah, The Beguiled as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, all right. So it's
it's better than The Beguiled.
Yeah,
I haven't seen My Cousin Rachel, but.
Okay, My Cousin Rachel was good.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Okay, cool. All right, well, listen, Eric, you also are the only one who saw Girls Trip.
Oh, am I?
Yeah, and I saw your post. It's 122 minutes long.
122 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. The only reason that I'm interested in seeing, and man, it made a lot of money.
Yep.
People just didn't want to see Rough Night.
No.
But they wanted to see this.
Yep.
So the only reason that I'm even remotely interested in this movie is because of Tiffany Haddish, who I just think is hilarious.
Now, is that because, I mean, I didn't know who she, I had to look her up when you told me, you know, if she, you text me and asked me if she was any good in the movie.
Yeah.
So I had text and I looked her up, and I forgot that she was, the cop in Keanu.
Yeah, she was in Keanu, but that's
right.
Not, she's a stand-up, and her stand-up is great, and she was a regular for many episodes on At Midnight. and
which I don't watch.
Right, which she killed every time she was on. And she's been, you know, she's had small roles in other movies and stuff. And, you know, I mean, she didn't really get to do a ton of funny stuff in Keanu. She had a couple of laughs.
No.
But I mean, she's really, really funny, and she's a great stand-up. In fact, she's coming to Zany's, I think, in September.
Okay.
But I think she's great, and that was the only reason that I was even interested in seeing the movie.
Okay.
So.
Well, I appear to be, in the minority about this film. I'll tell you exactly what it's about. It's very much like, it starts off very much like Rough Night. It's a group of female friends who were very close, growing up and in college, and they used to get together, quite regularly, but, you know, jobs and responsibilities taken over, so they only get together, every few years. And they're getting together, once again, I believe it's for the Essence Festival.
That's what it is. In New Orleans, yeah.
In New Orleans, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it's Jada Pinkett Smith, Regina Hall, Tiffany Haddish, and Queen Latifah. And, you know, each of them have their own issue. Regina Hall is going down there. She's the most successful of the group. She is looking to set up this new corporate deal with, you know, her and her husband do some kind of food company or something like that. And they're going down to show off their brand and hopefully sign some big deal. But she finds out very early on that he is cheating on her again. So they have about working that out. Queen Latifah happens to be someone who is on the verge of being broke. She runs a sort of a self-put-together gossip blog that just doesn't do very well, so she's not in very good shape. Jada Pinkett Smith has had a couple kids. She's not married anymore, and she's kind of put aside her wild days, so she's the stiff upper lip, dressing down kind of character. Mm-hmm. And then Tiffany Haddish is the party girl who is pretty much a psychopath in the film. And I'm not mincing words here, because when we're introduced to this character, she has just beaten the hell out of someone at work for taking her lunch. Okay. And that's just the start of her psychopathy throughout the film. So the four of them go down to the festival, and, you know, wackiness ensues along with the drama. Basically, what you have here is an R-rated Tyler Perry film. And I don't know why people aren't recognizing this, because the only core thing that's kind of getting us through this movie as far as any kind of plot strand is concerned is the infidelity going on with Regina Hall's character. It's the only real sort of attempted drama throughout the film. Like, you know, the Queen Latifah stuff is kind of in the background. Tiffany Haddish's character is just being loud and obnoxious the entire movie, and Jada Pinkett Smith's entire arc involves her getting sexier throughout the movie and wanting to hook up with the big hunk that she finds down in New Orleans. That's the entire arc of all these characters. And then throughout, like, whatever sort of comic set pieces are brought about, you've seen one in the trailer that involves a zip line and a unfortunate bathroom incident.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a tag to that scene that involves Tiffany Haddish that just confirms, you know, what a psychopath she is. There's another scene where they all get, where Tiffany Haddish gives all the women a massive dose of absinthe, and they hallucinate at a party together. These are the ideas of, you know, big comic moments that are on display in this movie, and it's all tired. It's not funny. I laughed once in the entire movie. I couldn't stand Tiffany Haddish's character. None of the other characters register as anything beyond a one-dimensional, template.
Yeah.
I think Regina Hall and Jada Pinkett Smith are fine in the movie. Queen Latifah barely registers throughout it. And it's 122 minutes.
I can't.
122 minutes.
I can't imagine. Rough Night was like 90 minutes.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is 122 minutes.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, it's no different than a Tyler Perry movie. It really isn't, except that it's just raunchier.
Yeah. Malcolm D. Lee directed this movie, and he's directed some good movies in the past.
Undercover Brother.
Undercover Brother. I like The Best Man. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember. I think there's another one that I
like. Well, he did the Best Man Holiday as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He did the last Barbershop movie.
Oh, yeah, the last Barbershop movie. Well,
mm-hmm.
And he did Scary Movie 5. I just looked it up. I liked Roll Bounce.
Yeah. Roll Bounce is okay.
Yeah. But Undercover Brother is a really funny movie.
Yeah, but I'll give all the credits to that to the script.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's more the script and the act of the comedians on display than his direction. I mean, because there is no real sense of direction in this movie. It's the movie's very haphazard. I couldn't tell you how the scenes connect one into the other. Every other scene involves, you know, whether or not Regina Hall is going to call out her husband or not. And then Tiffany Haddish says something raunchy and does something with a banana that I can't describe on the air and a grapefruit.
Uh-huh. All right.
I hated this movie.
Okay, so that's Girls Trip. Is it getting good reviews?
Yes.
It is.
It's like 86%.
On Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I cannot believe what I'm seeing.
Wow.
And most of the praise, I'll say, you know, you can see it and you can tell me, but most of the praise is going to Tiffany Haddish.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't tend to laugh at psychopaths.
Okay. All right. That's too bad because she's funny. All right, Eric, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Childress is with us. Colin and Jim couldn't be with us, so just Eric and I are handling the movies, and we've got a couple of more to talk about here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we'll come back and review another movie right after this on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. Let's bring Eric back here to talk about more movies. All right, Eric.
All right.
All right. Care to take a crack at Valerian and the... And the City of a Thousand Planets. You can handle this one.
Oh, I'll give it a shot.
I mean, I've seen it. So
oh, good.
Yeah,
that's a good start.
No, it's not.
Refresh your memory here.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is the latest film from your favorite director, Luc Besson.
He's being sarcastic, but
yeah, yes. Yeah, of course I am.
Yes.
And the movie is set well into the future. It's the 28th century, where what began as sort of everyone, you know, Earthlings meeting in space on a, you know, for the space station that's, you know, hovering out there. More and more races and aliens and whatnot all commuted to the spaceship until it eventually had to be thrust out into space because it was getting too close to the Earth's atmosphere, which is now known as Alpha, aka the City of a Thousand Planets. And we're introduced to Valerian and Loreline, played by Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne. And there are sort of like secret agents of the police force for Alpha or the universe, one of those two. And they are tasked with finding this exotic creature that is part of an ancient civilization that has since been wiped out. At least that's what Valerian dreamt about. So this creature is capable of replicating stuff by taking a crap, apparently.
Yep.
Yeah. And you just put the thing in the mouth, and it, you know, it craps duplicates.
Yeah.
So they find the creature, and then they are summarily tasked with protecting one of the majors in the military force, played by Clive Owen. And they begin to discover that this ancient civilization may not have been completely wiped out, at least not some of the inhabitants, and becomes this sort of, race to discovery. I don't even know if it's a race, but just a journey of discovery of exactly how the civilization got wiped out, who might have been responsible for it, and what they can do to, you know, further the evolution of the remaining race. I don't know if that's the best plot description of the movie, but I'm guessing it's probably more than you remembered.
Oh, yeah.
About it.
Yeah.
So I mentioned this is the latest from Luc Besson, who, if you've seen The Fifth Element, that's pretty much, you know, the closest you can probably describe as far as a visual landscape is involved in this film. It's based on a comic book, and there's a lot of ideas on display, I suppose, not exactly molded into absolute coherence, but I will give a couple positives towards the movie. One, if we are comparing it to The Fifth Element, I will say it is not as aggressively annoying as The Fifth Element got. Both films have the sort of the, I guess, trademark Luc Besson humor, which is not a very good standard
for
humor.
Yeah.
But in Fifth Element, by the time Chris Tucker rolls around, you're pretty much dead in the water. You're either in for the ride or you're completely gone.
Yeah.
This movie, I think, at least gets started off on the right foot. I think the first 10, 12 minutes of the film, before we're even introduced to the main character, Valerian, has at least some of the best, most restrained visual storytelling Luc Besson has done in some time, probably in his entire career. Then even when the movie sort of kicks into action mode for a little bit, it slowly starts to kind of come apart. I mean, the action isn't particularly great. There's a whole virtual reality-esque chase scene that happens very early in the film that you need a better director to pull something like that off. Then you get to a point where the movie just decides to stop dead, even though one of the characters has been kidnapped and on the verge of possible death. The movie literally stops so Rihanna can do a cabaret number, thanks to Ethan Hawke, who shows up very late in the film as well.
Yeah,
I mean, this is not a good film. I throw the positives out because I don't think it's, I had a better time. Better time is a loaded phrase. I liked it more than I liked Girls Trip. I'll say that much.
Wow.
Yeah. Saw them one after the other. Girls Trip and then Valerian. That was my order.
By the way, that's 4 hours and 20 minutes.
It was a long afternoon. I was questioning life choices after that. So at least the movie has a visual landscape to it that I will give some credit for. Storytelling is not Luc Besson's strong suit. Dane DeHaan is very miscast as Valerian. I don't even think it's his fault. I just think the way that the character is written is not very interesting. I think Carol Delevingne is better of the two characters. Clive Owen is completely wasted. Ethan Hawke is kind of embarrassing. The Rihanna stuff is completely out of left field. And, Girls Trip is 122 minutes. This is 137.
Yeah.
So, going no on Valerian.
All right. Hang on a second, Eric. That's Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. I will give you my review. That's all coming up right after the break here and the news on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studios, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. It is Monday, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. Colin Suter could not join us. He had an early gig that he had to do. Jim Leskowski was going to join us, but he had some issues with his phone and the power at his place, so he couldn't do it. So Eric Childress and myself are handling the new movies, and we'll get back to it in a couple of seconds. We will also talk about box office as well. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and also at Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. So like us right now. It's Monday. That means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. Brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And we're going to talk food. We got a lot of fun food topics to get to for this Monday morning. But we're in the middle of the movie reviews. And before the break and the news, Eric told you about Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets and gave you his review, and it wasn't a very good one. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, I hated every frame of this movie. I hated it. Luc Besson, it's beyond me. Seriously. I don't understand the appeal. I know people who love his movies. I'm trying to remember if I've liked any of his movies, and I don't think I have.
I like one.
Which one is that?
The Professional.
I'm trying to
figure... I will say the Luc Besson's greatest accomplishment to date is giving us Natalie Portman.
Okay, that and also helping to write Taken.
Okay.
That's the
fair enough.
And produce Taken. I'll give him that. But I'm looking at the I'm looking at this list now. I just pulled this stuff up.
Yeah.
And it's let's see. Lucy was bad.
Yep.
The Family was terrible.
Oh God.
I don't even know what some of these are. I guess he must have done a couple of movies back in France that didn't get released here,
yeah,
or something. Okay, I'm looking at that. And oh my God, the Joan of Arc movie, one of the worst movies I've ever seen
ever
in my life. And that also, because of that movie, Catherine Bigelow didn't get a chance to direct her Joan of Arc script.
Right, so double trouble.
Exactly. The Fifth Element, horrible. One of the worst movies ever made. I don't like The Professional. I hate La Femme Nikita. I didn't hate The Big Blue, the diving movie.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't hate that. And I thought Subway was okay, the first movie that really kind of broke for
mm-hmm.
him. I thought it was okay. But other than that, I mean, he's responsible for some of the movies that I hate more than anything.
Yeah.
And this is right up there. I just mm-hmm. was like, this is just noise, man. It's just, and I saw it in 3D. And I got to say this, the 3D effects were, the 3D effects were good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one good thing I can say about it, is that it was clearly, it was shot in 3D and it was meant to be in 3D. And visually, as far as like 3D effects go, it's good. But I just find his visual style to be, in his mind, I think he thinks he's wildly imaginative.
Oh, yeah.
But he really isn't. There's nothing, I mean, like you get wacky looking creatures and you get Brianna doing a dance number and, you know, all these weird aliens and and everything is just loud. And the color scheme drove me crazy and I just couldn't, you know, and there are clearly no characters to attach any kind of feeling onto, you know,
absolutely
there's
not,
which also means that there is no, absolutely no suspense.
Right.
You don't care about these two lead characters. They're both really boring.
Right.
And like I said, I don't find anything about Luc Besson to be imaginative or creative. I just find it dull and really stupid. And just like his movies are stupid and his sensibility is stupid. And whatever comedy, I don't know where he – don't know.
French.
I don't understand what could be even remotely funny about any of the stuff that he does. And again, this is, I think this is like a companion piece to The Fifth Element.
Oh, it is.
And you know, and so that's something that I don't need.
No.
The one good thing I could say about it is that Chris Tucker's not in it. That's the only that's the only good thing I can say
about
it.
Yeah, that's why it's better than The Fifth Element. yeah, and it's, I mean, I mean you keep using the word noise, and I've heard that used many times. Just because it's overstuffed visually and things like that. But I find the movie just more dull than noisy. I mean, I didn't feel like Fifth Element, I felt was like aggressively like trying to, you know, like poke me, like, see, it's funny.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. Like everything was wacky. Everything was, a joke. When I'm just like, wait, I thought I'm watching like this science fiction movie and everything in the movie is just a joke.
Yeah.
But it's not a comedy.
Well, it's, the thing about The Fifth Element was, I mean, that The Fifth Element is an aggressively annoying movie.
Yeah.
Like to the point where I seriously wanted to smash my head in with a ball peen hammer.
Mm-hmm.
This one, and I agree with you, this one is more dull than annoying, but.
Yeah, particularly in the second half.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, Ethan Hawke, I don't understand what I'm guessing Clive Owen needs work because he hasn't, I guess the Steven Soderbergh TV show is done now, so.
Well, how about maybe give Rutger Hauer something to
do? Yeah, exactly. If you're going to put Rutger, that's another, I'm glad you brought that up.
I've got the whole movie, I'm just like, well, surely Rutger Hauer is going to show up as like the mystery villain or something.
Yeah.
No.
Nothing. And
no, he shows up, gives an announcement about the prologue, and then he's done.
Yeah, that's it. And if you can't. Don't put Rutger Hauer in a movie if you're not going to use Rutger Hauer correctly.
Right.
For God's sake.
Rutger Hauer is more in the Blade Runner 2049 trailer than he is in this. He's not even in that movie.
So I hated it. Maybe the worst movie. Maybe the worst movie I've seen all year, in my opinion.
That seems harsh.
I hated it.
Okay.
I just hated it. All right. All right. Listen, how about we go to the complete, absolute opposite.
Yeah.
All right. Tell everybody about Dunkirk. This director here, you kind of like him.
Yeah. His name is Christopher Nolan. And you may have heard me say some very positive things on the show, as you have as well, especially as of late. And this is his, I hesitate to use the word epic because normally we describe the word epic as a very long movie sometimes. It gets lumped into that. But this is his 106 minute opus, shall we say, about the retreat of British soldiers during a very sticky time in World War II, where reportedly somewhere around 400,000 soldiers were basically trapped. They were surrounded on the beachhead. They couldn't go back in town, otherwise they'd be shot. So they're trapped on the beachhead between the town, the Nazis, and the water. And Christopher Nolan tells the story in three parts, simultaneously playing out one over the other. You have the story on the beach with all the soldiers that are there, including one particular soldier, played by Fionn Whitehead, mm-hmm. I think is his name, mm-hmm. Who is basically, you know, just trying to get off like everybody else off the beach, trying to find his way onto a ship, even if that means just bringing a wounded soldier on there so he can find his place. Kenneth Branagh plays a commanding officer, just sitting back, just, you know, waiting basically for, you know, any naval ships to get in there to get their troops off the beach. Problem is that there's very shallow water, and you can't exactly bring a battleship into that kind of terrain. So then you have a secondary story where back home, and they keep repeating how close they are to home because they can actually see it across the water. Looks can be deceiving, but they can see home. It's right there. So on the other side, you have civilians with their own fishing boats and, you know, whatever, you know, mode of transportation they possibly have to get across the water and start picking up these soldiers themselves. Now, while they're doing that, Germans have air support, and they're out there looking to pick off anyone who's possibly going to take any of these soldiers off the beach. But thankfully, we have air support on our side as well. Tom Hardy plays one of the pilots. I forgot to mention Mark Rylance plays boat owners who brings with him a couple of young guys with him to help out.
One being his son, yes.
One being another local boy.
Right.
Tom Hardy plays one of the Spitfire pilots who is out to protect these boats. And Cillian Murphy shows up as one of the soldiers trying to escape, who ends up on one of the boats and due to massive trauma is in not the greatest state of mind. So
okay. All right. Hang on right there, Eric.
Okay.
All right. And then we'll come back and talk more about it. That's Eric Childress giving you the rundown on what Dunkirk is about, Christopher Nolan's latest, and we'll tell you how we feel about it right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. My dad will be calling in to tell a jokey time, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And we're going to talk food and have some more fun right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Before the break, Eric Childress. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Told us about Dunkirk. And I want to mention really quickly, you did mention the three parts, the three storylines that mm-hmm. are happening. I just wanted to mention really quickly that the first one is called The Mole, and it takes place over the course of a week.
Yeah.
The second one is The Sea, and that takes place over the course of a whole day. And the third one is From the Sky, and that takes place over the course of an hour. And that is intricate in the way that the story is told. And Colin posted something. Colin, by the way, loved the movie because he can't be here this morning. But he posted something on his Facebook page. It's very important. Get to this movie on time, because if you miss the first 5 minutes, you will be completely confused because of the way it's structured, the way it's set up. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Make sure you get to this movie on time, because otherwise you're going to be very confused once the story really kicks in and once Nolan messes around with time like he loves to do.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. So go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. What'd you think?
No, that was something is imperative to bring up.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
Because I was at the movie on time, just like Colin was. And, you know, it was as... great admirer of Christopher Nolan's work. I was still as curious as anyone how he was going to tell the story. Was it going to be told in kind of a traditional World War II or just war film, rescue kind of film, tragedies, you know, all the things that we're used to, you know, his Saving Private Ryan, if you will. And I was stunned when those title cards come up that you just mentioned, because I knew exactly what he was doing as soon as they came up. Like you said, the beach stuff, it just says 1 week. The boats, 1 day. The planes, 1 hour. And here you have Nolan, as you mentioned, playing around with time, not really in the same kind of way that Tarantino has played with time in Pulp Fiction and all, you know, all these other sort of movies that loop back upon themselves. Even though this movie, you know, does do a bit of that, it's within the Nolan framework and where he's testing the concept of time. This goes back all the way, you know, you can even, you know, talk about Following even. But, you know, specifically Memento. Obviously, and then followed up again beautifully in both Inception and Interstellar. And, you know, I mean, The Prestige plays with time structure and, you know, the way it tells the story as well. And he's, you know, he's just a fan of, you know, editing stuff that way. But to tell this story in this manner brings it to a greater sense of artistry that a lot of filmmakers would not be able to pull off, because he manages to tell these three stories, loop them up, you know, one upon each other, giving you exactly where everyone is at any given time, not, you know, putting a clock on the screen to let you know specifically what it is, but you hear the ticking on the soundtrack, the ticking clock on the soundtrack. And it is more powerful than any sort of time stamp he could possibly put on it, because this is a movie, a story, where every tick counts. And it is just, it is stunning to behold on one viewing, so much so that it's been about a week now since I've seen the movie, and I need to go back and see it again, because I want to experience everything that he's putting into this movie, everything he's putting into every bit of storyline. It's not a movie, even though, you know, we mentioned all these actors' names. You know, it's not the kind of movie that's told out through dialogue. There are Branagh is about the closest thing to any sort of exposition machine you have in this movie. This movie is told visually and through sound and motion and the action and the screams and the tragedy. And everything, again, comes down to that ticking clock, that or the way things are, you know, looped back upon itself, and the way that Hans Zimmer's score, just as it did with Inception, is bringing together all these levels, for, you know, lack of a better term, together into until they're all converging upon the same minute and the same second by the end of the film. I don't think I've ever seen a war film told in this manner before, and it's one of the reasons why Nolan receives such extraordinary praise, because he's really a master craftsman in what he's doing here, and it just it exemplifies that you can do big budget spectacles with brains and artistry, and you know, it's the kind of movie that deserves to be studied and experienced. And I know, you know, there's about eight different ways you can experience this movie. I saw it in the most basic manner possible, and you saw it in a different manner, which I can't wait to hear about.
I saw it in IMAX,
And I want to experience it in every possible way with as many people as I could possibly experience it with. It is a masterful piece of work.
And by the way, the other way that you can see it is 70 millimeter. And I know there are a couple of other places around the town, but Music Box is showing it in 70 and have like been sold out. Like this past weekend, there were lines around the block to see it. I saw it in IMAX. It was shot with 70 millimeter and IMAX film. So and let me say something to you, Eric. You got to see it in IMAX. I mean, I'm going to see it. I'm going to see it in 70. You know, I'm going to go back and see it in 70. But in IMAX, I'm telling you, man, it's astonishing, and I can't even explain to you the use of sound now.
Oh yeah,
but in IMAX, I mean, that the first bullet that is fired, I almost had a heart attack. But those are the formats in which to see it. If you can see it in IMAX, see it in IMAX. If you can see it in 70, see it in 70. If you can't see it in either, see it anyway.
Yeah.
Hang on, Eric, okay?
Okay.
Come back. I'll give you my review, and we'll bat it around a little bit.
Yeah.
We're talking about Dunkirk, which is Christopher Nolan's new movie, and it is a great one. We'll take a break for the news, and we come back. We'll finish up talking about Dunkirk, and then we'll talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Colin Suter had an early gig. He couldn't join us. Jim was going to join us, Liskowski, but he couldn't because his power went out and his phone was dead. So Eric and I had to handle the new movies this week. Let's bring Eric back. It's too bad that Colin and Jim couldn't join us, or at least either of them couldn't join us, considering this week, you know, what came out.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
And I know they both loved it. We can say that. But we're talking about Dunkirk, which is Christopher Nolan's new movie. And I echo everything you said, Eric. I thought the movie was astonishing. I just absolutely brilliant. It's unlike any war movie I've ever seen. And it's, I think, one of the greatest war movies ever made. And I'm saying that right now. I think it's one of the greatest war movies ever made. The brilliance in which he decided to tell these stories in the manner in which he did is so unusual and so creative. And it works so well to build up the suspense. And the final moments of the movie are just mind-bogglingly great. You know, there's not a lot of dialogue in it. It's more told visually, and it's a very, the thing about it is it's a massive story. It's a story from World War II that many, many, many people remember and have studied. And it involves over 400,000 soldiers. So it's on a really big level. You know, I mean, this is like, as you said, this is like big budget entertainment right here, but it feels insanely intimate. To the point where I couldn't believe how involved I was with these characters and what was happening. And you were in there. You know, there are scenes that take place in this. A bunch of the soldiers go into this boat waiting for the tide to come in.
Yeah.
And that whole sequence is just insane. And it's intercut with a scene involving, you know, one of the pilots. And that's intercut with that and what's going on the boat with Mark Rylance. And Mark Rylance, by the way, is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. And it's all cut together beautifully. Although I got to say this, we get to see less of Tom Hardy's face than when he played Bane.
Well, during the movie, all I could think of is just like, you know, all the people that gave Christopher Nolan crap for, you know, Bane's voice in Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
He just went, oh, yeah? I'm going to put Hardy in a mask again, people.
I'm going to put him in a mask. He's in a mask the entire movie.
Yeah.
Basically, you don't really get to see his face until the end.
No, but at the same time, that only exemplifies what a masterful performance it is.
Oh, it's great. It's a great performance. And I love the little vocal cameo by Michael Caine.
Sure.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, you got to keep Michael Caine's got to be
right
in there. But no, this is really, truly, it's a masterpiece. It is a movie that I can't wait to see it again. And he's using the technology. This is a guy, clearly Christopher Nolan is a guy who loves film, and the theatrical experience, and wants it to be the best that it can possibly be. This guy cares about the qualities of the movies that he makes, and he wants it to be a cinematic experience, like a massive, you know, incredible cinematic experience. And that's exactly what this movie is.
Yeah.
And it never stops from the moment it starts. It just never stops. And like you said, the only time that it slows down a little bit is when Kenneth Branagh has to give out, you know, a few of the things of what's happening. But that's about it. And there are just, you know, moments of unbelievable brilliance throughout. This is top-notch filmmaking. I mean, this is the reason I go to movies. And I loved every frame of it. And, I the performances are all strong. How about Harry Styles? What's going on there?
Yeah.
Where did that come from? What the hell is the guy from One Direction doing giving a kick-ass performance in a Christopher Nolan movie?
Yeah.
It's like, what? But anyway, it's an amazing
piece. And it needs to be said, because Nolan has been accused in the past, and we've disputed this many times here on your show, of being kind of a cold, emotionless filmmaker. You know, we've argued how the ending of Inception actually has a huge emotional payoff.
Yeah.
Interstellar, obviously, you know, it has huge emotional stakes to it.
Yeah.
And this movie, you know, with all its technical brilliance and as great as the all the violence and the action is in it, the dog fighting scenes are just astounding.
Unbelievable. Especially, yeah. Eric, you got to see it in IMAX. It's ridiculous, man. It's ridiculous.
But beyond all that, it builds up to a incredibly emotional climax.
Absolutely. The final moments in this movie, I mean, in the final shot,
yeah.
It's great, man. I've never really thought he was in. I even think Memento has a lot of emotion in it.
It does.
I mean, and the Stephen Tobolowsky stuff in Memento is heartbreaking, you know,
mm-hmm.
he's I don't think he's a cold filmmaker except for the damn Batman movies.
Yeah, those we disagree.
I know, but those are the only ones. Seriously, it's the only thing.
Yeah.
All of his other movies have hit me on every level. I think he's an extraordinarily talented director who tells stories in an original, interesting way. When did you ever think that you would see a war movie and not know what step it was going to take next? You know, it's a genre that we all know that are, you know, I mean, everybody has seen a million war movies and we all know how they go from A to B to C. Not this one.
No,
not this one at all. And the fact that he told the story in that way, it's just great, man. And I loved it. I'm going to see it again. I'm going to see it in 70. But if you got to see it in IMAX, you got to see it in 70. It is an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, really, really, really.
And I also want to, let people know, you know, we're talking about the way he tells a story, and, I don't want people to think that it's some sort of gimmick he's using at the expense of the intimate people story that are involved in this movie, because not only does it build to, a real emotional climax, but I think this movie actually has something very profound to say about heroism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this movie is about retreat. This is runaway.
Yeah.
But the movie makes the argument that, that's okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And it explores it on so many different levels too. I mean, the fighting in the sky is on a different level. The stuff on the boat between Mark Rylance and Cillian Murphy is amazing, and also puts you in what would I do in that situation?
Right.
What are we going to do? And every single segment of the movie has one or two amazing heroes, and you're following these people and what they're doing and how they handle it. And each storyline has a different definition of heroism.
Yeah,
it's great, man. It's just great. So, all right, and it made a lot of money.
Did well.
Okay, let's talk about the box office. Number one, Dunkirk with 50.5 million. Is that about what everybody thought?
No, it's more. I mean, it's what I thought.
Yeah.
not to toot my own horn, but it's pretty much exactly what I thought it was going to make. The estimates for weeks have been in sort of like the mid to high 30s.
Mm-hmm.
People have been just kind of downplaying as just like no stars, World War II movie, middle of summer.
Right.
I'm just like, no, it's a Christopher Nolan movie, and it's opening against nothing.
Right.
So, no offense to Girls Trip, but it opened exactly what I thought it did, and when you know that Christopher Nolan's fan base, and he has a fan base because he makes good movies.
Yeah.
Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
And he has a history. His, people, even if they don't start off with huge, huge numbers, they do tend to grow over, because the word of mouth is so sensational.
Word of mouth is going to be massive for this thing.
I think it is, too.
I mean, my parents went nuts over it.
Great.
They thought it was amazing. We were afterwards, we talked for 20 minutes in the car about how stunning it was.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that, a lot of adults went to this weekend, and I think they will continue to do that. But the way the word of mouth seeps out, the screen I was at the other night, when Harry Styles' name came on the screen at the end of the movie, like huge eruption of, teenage girls in the movie, watching a World War II movie just to see him. So this movie does cross, checks a lot of boxes.
Yeah.
And the way that the rest of the summer is kind of going to play out, the way it looks, that this movie, and I think this movie is probably going to be number one again next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're going to see it play all the way through August into September. Obviously it's going to be a huge Oscar player.
Without
when
question.
It comes out.
Without question.
Yeah. And so, this is that movie that people are going to be wanting to see. If it make, I don't know if it's going to make $200 million yet. We'll see how it does in the next couple of weeks. But I think you're looking at probably no less than like 165.
Well, I mean, it's got to do amazing in the UK, right?
Oh,
I mean,
it's
got to be massive in the UK.
Yeah, it's already made made like 55 million so far.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's directed in the UK, but overseas in general.
Right.
So it's already made over $100 million worldwide, and I suspect it'll eventually do over half a billion.
Yeah, good. I hope it makes $8 trillion.
There you go.
Girls Trip came in with a massive amount of money, $30 million. Wow.
Yeah, this movie looks like it's going to beat Rough Night and Snatched combined. Man. When all is said and done. I mean, $30 million, it's a $19 million budgeted film.
Wow.
So Universal's doing handstands right now. They're probably already talking about, you know, Girls Trip to Vegas, Girls Trip to Paris,
sure.
You know, all that kind of crap.
Yeah.
You know, cheaply made movie, and you can get an audience. And they clearly sold it well, and there hasn't been any movies really this whole summer aimed at an African-American audience.
That's true.
You know, yeah. So you got that factor as well, and I think that, you know, it's kind of like the perfect storm. Like, they rejected the other movies, and they said, no, I'm going to go see this one.
Yeah. Spider-Man Homecoming, $22 million, bringing its total up to $251 million. How's that one holding up?
Doing fine. Yeah. Doing fine. It's kind of right now toying with whether or not it's going to get over the $300 million mark. It's kind of echoing a little bit better than what Man of Steel did. Next weekend is going to be kind of key. Man of Steel did $291 million, so it's kind of a little bit higher than that now.
Yeah.
So it's doing fine, but it's also like $570 million worldwide, so it's fine.
War for the Planet of the Apes dropped big. $20 million, it's made $97.7 million. Why?
I think because people were expecting more war.
Yeah, I guess
I honestly think that they showed up and, you know, they were expecting the big, you know, loud conclusion to this trilogy that they've supported, because Dawn, Rise did was a surprise hit. Dawn did even better.
Yeah.
And I think that people showed up expecting something different, and when they got a sort of slower, more meditative kind of story with a kick-ass ending, they just, it was just like, nah.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Wait.
It's terrific, though. I mean, people should see it. Number five, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, $17 million. Is that about what everybody thought?
Some people were expecting it to be higher, which I thought was generous. It's a little higher than I thought it was going to do, frankly.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting stat, is that there have only been like a couple movies that have been budgeted at $175 million or more that opened worse than this.
Mm-hmm.
Like Battleship was like a $200 million movie, grossed $25 million in its opening weekend.
Yeah.
And that was like the lowest.
Oh, boy.
And this movie cost over $209 million.
Yeah, well, you can tell.
Yeah.
All right, next week, Atomic Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do we got next week?
Well, very interesting. We got the Emoji Movie.
Oh, God.
Which is not screening for critics.
Which is weird. Yeah.
Which is very weird. But they've also moved up Detroit next week.
What?
You didn't know this?
No.
Apparently nobody did, even though there was a press release that was sent out, and they've added some screenings for it here in Chicago this week, but it's opening on Friday.
Okay, well, that changes my weekend plans.
That's right.
So, all right. Well, the new Catherine Bigelow movie and Charlize Theron kicking some ass. Talk about women.
I think you're going to do just fine.
I think I'll be fine, yeah. All right. Yeah. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
Okay.
All right. There's Eric Childress. Colin Suter will be back next week. And I want to thank Eric for covering all the movies with us this morning. We'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. We got weather and we got traffic. And I got the weather for you right here.